Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. Tomorrow is Cavs Warriors 2, the second and final time the Cleveland Cavaliers and Golden State Warriors will play in the regular season. We all expect that they will play in the NBA Finals, but who knows that yet. And I wanted to preview this game and talked with Chris Manning, who writes for Fear of the Sword and hosts Locked On Cavs, about the game that we expect, what we hope to see. Conversation runs about a half an hour. Hope you enjoy it. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. We're both excited for the game, but it's good to preview it as well.
Yeah, it's going to be another very high-level game between two great teams. And the first one was just so great that it's kind of crazy we're getting the second one this fast.
It's also, in a way, disappointing because, not because it's so quickly, that's great, but because this is the last one until, you know, if they face each other in the finals. And so we won't get to see what these teams look like against each other between, like, the deadline and all the buyouts and everything like that. But Cleveland did make a big change, and we presumably will get to see Kyle Korver play against the Warriors.
Yeah, and that's kind of something that's interesting about the difference between these two teams in Game 2. I got a lot of questions for Locked On Cavs about if the Cavs needed to go get somebody by Game 2 to get them used to playing in this series, and I would argue no, that you don't. I didn't think it was necessary because the looks are going to change between now and the finals anyway, presuming those two teams meet, but it does hit on the thing that the Cavs only played 8 guys in the first game, and they played LeBron 40 minutes. Love played 32, and I think he would have played a lot more had he not gotten into foul trouble. Irving played 44 minutes, and you know the bench didn't play that much, and yes, J.R. Smith is out, and we've seen Kay Felder and Jordan McRae play some minutes since then, but Kyle Korver's another body, and he gets him to 9 guys. When you count J.R. Smith being back for presumably the finals, and assuming that his hands are going to end up being all right, that gets you to 10 guys. So I think the first game was, are the Cavs going to have a bodies problem over a 7-game series? And a couple weeks later, with the Korver move, thinking about J.R. Smith, I don't really know how much I think that's true.
It's a good point. And also, the idea that if JR suffers a setback or something else, Kyle Korver would probably be his replacement. And I expect that event, maybe by that point, maybe that'll be a little bit too fast, whether Korver will be that place in the starting lineup, or is the expectation that Liggins will have it for a little while longer.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. And I think the thing with Korver is that I think he's probably just a more natural shooting fit with the Cavs. I mean, JR's been a great piece for them. He does have to kind of do some dribbling and do some more crazy shots to get his shots off. Korver's going to be like Channing Frye in the sense that he's going to fit in really smoothly on that, and he's just going to have to catch it and shoot it. He's probably not as a high end of a defender. Not that Abdur's a great defender by any means, but JR has some athletic ability that he can tap into when he needs to. Korver doesn't exactly have that at 35, will be 36 in the finals, but I think he's playable in this series, especially in certain lineups, and I think that in itself has a ton of value.
We also will see whether Tyronn Lue wants to go to something that more closely resembles what they could look like with Korver replacing Smith, or whether they'd rather keep that mystery moving. I'm expecting, considering how quickly this game is after the transaction, I mean, it'll be a week, basically, since that he'll have played with the team, that Korver will come off the bench. But we'll still get to see how he fares against this team and with LeBron James, whether it's nominally as a starter or not.
I think 100% he's going to be coming off the bench for at least the foreseeable future, to be honest with you. I think they really like what Liggins brings in the starting lineup. I think he's not a good offensive player at all. I think we even saw in the first game the Warriors did ignore him some. They let him just kind of run around, which a lot of teams are smartly doing. With Kyle Korver, you can't just let him float around because LeBron will find him and he will shoot threes and make a lot of them. But I think you won't see that move unless you feel like Lue needs it, because I think he likes the kind of continuity they're having right now, and I think they do plan on having JR fill that spot when he gets back. And I think that makes sense, too. I mean, I think you do lose some shooting, of course, but it's the regular season. And if you're Korver, you probably want to keep him as fresh as possible for the playoffs anyway, when presumably the spacing gets tighter. More attention is paid to LeBron and Kyrie and Kevin Love. And a guy like Korver, his value goes up then because he's going to probably get at least a chance to have more open looks in the course of a tight seven-game series than now when Liggins is just kind of going to be there to take the pressure off guys of having to try really hard on defense all game.
The other reason this is exciting, you and I talked before the last one about whether both teams would care, and it was blatantly clear that both teams cared. And we should see that again for the second game. Who knows how often we will see that moving forward. You know, this game is in mid-January, and these teams might not have another game like this until mid-May at the earliest. But it'll be exciting to see two of the best teams really go for it, whether that is in terms of minutes or just in terms of when they play will be open to question. But I'm just excited to see both of these teams engaged.
I am too. And I think the first game left a very clear mark on both teams. I think the Cavs were very satisfied with that win. And you would know better than me because you're around the team a lot. I don't think that loss set well with the Warriors, in particular with some of the losses that have happened since. I feel like this is maybe a statement game, because I mean, I think we are seeing people worry about the Warriors, and that's not really fair because they're absurdly good and they should still be the favorites to win the title. But when just the optics of losing to the Grizzlies like they did and then losing to the Cavs after being up by so much, that a statement win at home probably get some value in it. And I think like a guy like Draymond Green, I presume, is probably going to be pretty amped up for this game considering how the first one went and how sort of the last couple weeks have gone as well.
The way that I'm thinking about this one is that it really is a no-lose situation for the Cavs because they've already proven what they need to. They won that game. They are the reigning champions. They have all the confidence they need that they can beat the Warriors at Oracle. They've already done it. But the upside for Cleveland is the potential havoc it could wreak with the Warriors if they win again. So if they can do that, then the Warriors will have lost 5 straight games against the Cavs, all of which they really cared about. It isn't like, oh, there was a throwaway game or anything like that. I expect that we'll see both teams at as close to full strength as they can be at the point. And that could have some ripple effects. You brought up the Memphis game, and yeah, I mean, one of the big stories of that Cleveland finish was some failed execution by the Warriors, exactly the same pattern of a lead that they blew against Memphis, and they've actually blown a couple leads in games that they've won as well, something Draymond talked about after that Memphis game. And so it will be a litmus test for the Warriors of not whether they've changed anything, because it's too fast to really overhaul your team, but whether they can avoid some of the pitfalls that they have in prior games against good teams.
So let me ask you this: how much stock are you putting into some of the issues they're having at the end of games? Like, how much are you, as someone who's watching the team, saying, "Okay, this is a actual concern"?
It's a legitimate concern, to be sure. They are moving away offensively from what has been successful for most of the rest of the game in terms of ball movement and player movement, but it is a correctable issue, and it has now been more openly identified. I'm sure it was privately identified a while back. Like, this isn't anything new. But the Warriors last year were one of the best clutch teams in NBA history, partially because the defensive ceiling of those Draymond at center lineups is crazy high, but also partially because their offensive execution was beautiful late. Everybody knew their role, they knew how everything worked, and adding Kevin Durant makes the Warriors a better team. Overall, it raises their ceiling, but it's a big adjustment, and everybody has to figure out their place in this. And it's a fundamental difference from adding somebody like Kyle Korver, who fits in a role that is basically pre-established, preordained. They already know how to do it. They know how to deal with it. It's narrower. With Durant, he affects everything, and they will need to figure that out. It was an expectation, but considering the transition with only, you know, a fair amount of personnel turnover, but really one guy in the sense of crunch time execution, it is a little bit surprising. But at the same point, you know, like we all talked about, what is the adjustment going to be with Kevin Durant? And that's the easiest time to see it.
Yeah, and because it is the time that most teams, the Cavs are a prime example of this. That's when you revert to the iso ball. That is when you revert to playing a specific way that necessarily isn't the most functional way, because you're relying on one guy to do everything or two guys to do everything. And that's not been the Warriors' brand of basketball, but that was Kevin Durant's brand of basketball his whole time at Oklahoma City, right? Like, that, if there was ever a thing we really, really picked at them for, it was because him and Russ were just kind of trying to do everything on their own. And that's not, I mean, that isn't a very functional way to play. And that's not how the Warriors have approached the late games the last couple of years. Like, even if Curry's the guy taking the shot like he did against the Thunder in the playoffs last year, it's not a thing where he's just dribbling for 15 seconds or taking that iso, that three at the top of the key. And that's a different identity. And I wonder if for him, if it's breaking instincts, if it's breaking if it's breaking those habits, or if, and how much you actually have to push against that, right? Like, I mean, how much do you tell Kevin Durant to not do that, because he's really, really good at it. And it's just, let's not forget, the first game against the Cavs, I'm looking at his box score, and his overall field goal numbers weren't exactly, you know, the mind-blowing. Like, he's 11 of 23 from the field, 2 of 8 from 3. I felt like he was the best player on the floor that whole game.
Yep.
Like, I feel like if you're taking the whole game, Durant was clearly the most impactful player in that game.
I agree with you, and part of the reason why the late-game stuff is not a surprise is because you see it actually in the way the Warriors defend other teams. So the Warriors do a lot of, particularly the Draymond at center lineups, they do a lot of switching. And the idea for switching is that you're losing the seam. So basically, if a guy has to run around a screen, you're creating a pocket where that guy can shoot. And when you switch it, you're eliminating that by just changing the personnel. And so what you have to do against the switch is you have to attack it. Presumably it's creating a mismatch. And so that means that a lot of what the Warriors' offense is predicated on doesn't work because you're doing it in a different way. However, they have guys who are very adept at attacking switches. So what Durant needs to get better at in this sense, and he can do it. He does it over the course of games, over a career. He's one of the best scorers in the league in modern times, is attacking that switch in a more fruitful way, not just shooting a pull-up. There have been three times this year where he's had a big switch on him late. All three times he's, you know, gotten about to about 20 feet, or against Zach Randolph on the last play of the Memphis game, to a three-pointer, shot it. None of them were terrible looks. None of them were great looks either. And he can do more with that. He is a very good handle. He can drive to the lane. He can try to force help in some other way. And so the irony of it is that that's what the Warriors are trying to do to every other team's offense most of the game. And when it happens to them, they're not totally comfortable dealing with it. But that is exactly the type of thing that they'll have to work on with time. And they presumably will try to work on with the Cavs, but it'll depend on whether that game is close late.
Yeah, and I hope that, I mean, this is looking, and kind of looking at this in a way that so many things could just break one way. And again, it won't matter that much, in which I think we talked about last time, but I hope this game is close late, right? Like, I hope, because we won't see this for months, and because we're going to put a lot of stock into this, whether we should or not, and because it's going to shape our opinions of these two teams' current statuses in a lot of ways. Because, I mean, I think the Cavs for this, there's a good chance LeBron takes his sabbatical, right? Like, I mean, if this is the point of the year where I expect him maybe to take that, because you've played the Warriors twice, because they have a decent lead over the Raptors in the Eastern Conference, and I'm not even sure that matters to them that much. This would be the last time that maybe we evaluate them in a big way until JR gets back. And I know Korver's working himself in too, so it's hard to take that in the stock. But I hope we kind of see some of the things we wonder about these teams play out. And I also just want to know, how much is Steph Curry going to assert himself in this game too? Because, I mean, after Christmas Day, if I remember correctly, he was a little bit kind of frustrated, it seemed, with how things played out for him. He wants more of the pick and rolls, which isn't a very Warriors play. And he took 11 shots in that first game. And that, I mean, that's for what they did and for how many shots they took as a team, that's sort of a decent number. But then you think, it's Steph freaking Curry. Is this guy going to shoot more? And he himself, 4 of 11, 2 of 7 for him isn't exactly Steph Curry numbers in a game, in a matchups where he can really go off. Like, if Kyrie Irving's defending him, he can go off. Like, he's capable of doing that over a whole game.
The Christmas Day game actually caused a little bit of a sea change in the way that Curry has approached things. He's gotten a lot more assertive since then. Kind of like the Memphis game reinvigorated them in terms of aggression in that way, but that they've only played, you know, a little bit since then. But Curry has been much more assertive. He's been more like himself, shooting pull-ups, as you said, running more pick and roll, and realizing that he has to be the centerpiece of a lot of these things. And they've been making a more concerted effort to have the ball in his hands, which is certainly a good thing when a guy is a two-time reigning MVP. And we'll see whether that comes into play against Cleveland. And also, if Cleveland goes to switching, how the Warriors choose to attack that, because they can post up Kyrie Irving. If Irving draws the Curry assignment and they switch the pick and roll, they can run, you know, Curry on that big, which famously failed in Game 7, but had worked broadly for the Warriors in their championship year and before that. So all of those sorts of things, how they approach the basic elements that we know will be there, in some ways is more interesting because we can anticipate that, as opposed to, you know, what if the game is close late, where we just don't know.
Yeah, and I that's interesting too. Like, the whole Curry thing is just so interesting because he's clearly great, and it's, you know, the idea of him slumping is kind of crazy because his numbers, I mean, I think, didn't he have a quote where he was like, like, if this is a slump, like, I'm glad to have these numbers or something like that, like something along those in that vein of thought.
I haven't heard it, but it wouldn't surprise me if he said it and I just missed it.
Yeah, I maybe, like, I'm just imagining that, I guess, but
it's very possible he did.
Yeah, yeah. He's a guy in this matchup where it's, like, crazy to think this, but he's, like, an X factor, right? Like, Draymond's the ultimate X factor in this, because him getting really mad during that first game and getting in foul trouble, like, impacted a lot of things. Kevin Love, to the same extent, getting in foul trouble definitely played an impact on the Cavs' struggles, I think, especially in that third quarter and until they kind of came all the way back. Curry against Kyrie late is just this fascinating thing, because on offense, he can torch Kyrie, and you could argue that him going one-on-one against Kyrie is if you're going to do that, you want the ball in his hands against Kyrie. You don't necessarily want to run the pick and roll then with him and LeBron or him and Durant, because LeBron has switched on him, and then you get Durant the ball. And you want to use him in that way, right? Like, it's kind of what the Cavs do with Kyrie and LeBron, is you run that pick and roll, you create these mismatches. Defensively, Kyrie's, if he gets the ball, he's going to go at Curry, and that's an issue. But you also, you saw how frustrated he was getting taken out of the game in the Christmas Day game. You don't want to, like, ever, I guess, put your star in this situation where he feels that way. Like, I mean, that's something you can't quantify without kind of knowing Curry deep down. But, like, that's just – he's such an X factor in this, because we didn't see the best Curry in the first game, and he didn't necessarily seem happy with the first game. And it wouldn't shock me if he drops, like, 45 in this game and he's the reason why the Warriors won by 15. That wouldn't shock me. But if he had another game like he had against the Cavs the first time, that wouldn't shock me either.
I'm interested in that, and also two other more basic tactical questions, which both, it's also the idea whether they treat it as a finals preview or whether they just treat it as a game for what it is, which is, how often will we see Klay on Kyrie? That's going to be very interesting, because the Warriors have gone to that at various moments in the past. Steph doesn't like that necessarily, but it can be tactically the right move. And then the other one is, how do the Warriors approach when Channing Frye comes in the game? Because Frye is a wonderful talent, but he has some specific weaknesses that if the Warriors go small, they can exploit. So how they approach that? Do they try to use one of their bigs and just see how it works? Do they throw Kevon Looney on him? Or do they go with Draymond at center? And if they do, how does Ty Lue react? And those sorts of basic questions are more interesting. As I said before, they're more interesting to me because we know we're going to see that. We know we're going to see Channing Frye in this game. There's no way that they can avoid that. So how they adapt to it, even if it's not representative of what they want to do in the finals, will still be interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's really key too, because last year we didn't see a lot of Channing Frye in the finals, right? Like, we saw him in the lead up to the finals. He did not play an important role in that final series. I don't think the Cavs, as currently constructed, David Griffin could go and get a big. He could do something where he uses whatever assets they have left or sign somebody that takes away some of the minutes that is a more traditional plotting, more rim protecting big. I don't necessarily believe that that's what they would do. I think if they're going to go get somebody else, they're going to get a point guard. Channing Frye is going to have to play 20 minutes, 17 to 20 minutes. Like, he played 17 minutes the first game, and he's going to do the one thing. He's going to shoot threes. But I think you're right. Like, he does have weaknesses. You can certainly run things at him and exploit him in space. But you also can attack him on the boards and beat him up there, because he's not a good rebounder. A lot of the rebounds he gets by the virtue of just being tall. He doesn't really use his body, and he's not exactly an overwhelmingly strong force. Draymond at the five is kind of a terrible matchup for him, because Draymond can attack him in space. Draymond's a good rebounder, and it's going to be definitely stronger than him. And just, can Ty Lue stick to him, or do you have to go with Love? And we know the issues with Love against Green too. I mean, Love can post him decently well. I think Love can hang on the rebounding battle. He certainly can pull Draymond outside. But if you attack with Draymond in the pick and roll against Love, that's a good thing for the Warriors. That's a good thing that's going to compromise the Cavs' defense when they do inevitably use one of those guys at the five, because they have to do it, I think.
Along those lines, I'm very excited to see how both of these teams approach help defense, because they can do a lot when you have this much offensive talent. They can do a lot to draw extra attention to that matchup, and that means that the remaining players have to do a lot of work. And so will whoever's not involved in the action, I mean, you could rattle off a list of guys on both teams, how will they scramble, how will they react to that? Because those guys are probably going to have a lot on their plates, or will they just go, it's a regular season game, we'll do that. But I think those, where kind of the fissure points are, is something to watch, because generally speaking, those stay the same, because the as long as the overall forces stay the same.
I think you're right. And I think how the Cavs approach defense is going to be really interesting, because they theoretically get have a lot of lineups where they have two or three average to minus defenders on the floor. And if you're going to, like, let's talk about Kyrie, he's obviously going to do a lot in terms of shot making, in terms of leading the offense. And he's, I do think he's been a lot better on defense. I think on Christmas Day, he was decently, like, for stretches dialed in, had seven steals, a lot of which were him nabbing sort of crazy passes and just kind of hustling, which for him is kind of rare. If he's also had games in between then, like I think of the Phoenix game where he just coasted on defense. And, you know, that's expected. I don't expect him to really do a lot on defense and focus on defense all the time. But his effort level in this game, I think, on that end, will tell you a lot about how the Cavs approach it. If he's going out there and he's diving for loose balls and he's jumping passing lanes and he's putting a lot of effort in defending Curry and working around screens, the Cavs' defense will look better for it. If he's not doing that and he's just letting Curry get open and he's just dying on screens, the Cavs could give up 125 points and the Warriors could just go off, and that wouldn't surprise me. And just how Love, to the same extent Love, is Love going to chase around screens? Is he going to do some of the things he did in space in the first game? Like, there was a sequence early in that first game where he got matched up on Curry inside and did a really nice job of contesting a Curry shot. But he could also have just put in the lack of effort there and just die, and it would have been an easy Curry bucket. But he put in the effort, and if they both do that, that changes the dynamic of the game, and that raises the level of the play of the game, because if those two guys are making the Warriors work, that's going to push Draymond to do more, that's going to push Curry to do more, that's going to push Durant to do more, and that's awesome. That's what we want, right?
It is what we want. Do you think they'll look to LeBron in terms of tone setting there? Because there, it seems like he sets so much of that example for those guys, and that if he says jump, they say how high.
You're right. I think that's 100% correct. I think how much LeBron goes at this with however he wants to attack it is kind of the most interesting thing of the Cavs' tone. Irving is getting better at setting the tone, and they're doing a better job of late with Irving kind of taking the mantle of things when LeBron is sitting on the bench. But, it's no surprise. The Cavs are worse, a lot worse, when LeBron is off, when LeBron is sitting on the bench and when he's not playing. They do suffer a lack of focus when he's out there. And I kind of wonder if this is a game where if LeBron has a game where he's like, okay, like, this is out of hand earlier, he's not totally dialed in, that becomes a problem. And I think if you even look at the first game, like, LeBron struggled during points of that game because he maybe was a little too amped up too. And if he gets like that, it does affect other guys. But it's also going to be a game where I think we haven't seen as much of the LeBron plus four bench guys this year. I think this is a game where I think it would make sense to see it. It's a way to incorporate Korver. It's a way to maximize LeBron against a team where you have to maximize him in order to win. And I think LeBron plus shooters would be really interesting to see against this Warriors team. And I also just want to know how much we actually will see a quote-unquote traditional Durant-LeBron battle. Because we didn't really have it in the first game. I would say there are aspects of it we saw. But neither team is necessarily built to play in a way where those guys are just going to go off at each other, right? Like, the Warriors' style is built on not having that. It is built on having a number of guys who can kill you and a number of elite guys. The Cavs have Kyrie, who's going to do some of the attacking on his own. They have Kevin Love, who they've done a better job of utilizing all year. Like, how much do we just get LeBron and Durant going at each other? And because I think one way or another, those two guys do dictate the game for their respective teams. Even if it's not directly, they shape their teams.
A lot of it is direct, too, and I'll echo that just from an entertainment perspective, but also from an analysis perspective. That would be great to see. And as somebody who, covered both of those finals, I want to see what Amon Shumpert can bring, because Shumpert was great overall in the 2015 finals. The Cavs ended up losing, but that wasn't his fault. And then 2016, he was still figuring everything out. And so what he can bring to them, especially considering right now they're just point guard issues, those will probably end up resolving themselves through buyouts, trades, whatever. But if he can show a little bit of, this is why you want him to be in your rotation at the bare minimum in a playoff series, as opposed to the struggles that he had on Christmas Day, would be significant, because he has already shown that he can play in this series eventually.
Yeah, and the Cavs do need him to play. And I think without a true backup point guard for this team, he is going to play a big role. And with Korver there, I think he goes back to some of the more point guardy things that he's done. I don't think Kay Felder is going to get much time in this game unless he has to. And the other thing with Shumpert that's going to be worth watching is he was a part of a Cavs bench that didn't play that great in the first game. He and Jefferson, the only two backup wings the Cavs played in that game, combined to shoot 3 for 20 from the field. Fry was 4-7, and he was good offensively, made an impact. The Cavs, except for two Jefferson dunks, which of course were big, and one Shumpert three-pointer, got nothing out of those guys. They did get 8 free throws from those guys as well, but not a lot of good jump shooting. Did the Warriors ignore Shumpert a little bit in this game? And Shumpert hasn't shot the three ball well of late either. He had one game in early December where he was 4-6, but he's had a couple. He had a string of games from the 31st to the 6th where he didn't make a single three. Shot well against the Suns last week, but he hasn't exactly been the scorching three-point shooter we saw earlier in the year, and that makes sense because he's not a good three-point shooter for his career. He's a guy who has a minimal impact in that sense, and the Warriors are probably going to leave him open, and that's what I would do personally. I would totally just leave Shumpert open. I mean, you make him beat you. Pack the paint on LeBron and Kyrie. That's the smart play.
Along the lines of those backups, one of the biggest surprises of the Christmas Day game was that Richard Jefferson did a pretty good job on Kevin Durant, and a lot of that, based on just almost every human being that is alive other than Kawhi Leonard, is that a guy has a good defensive game on Durant when he lets them. But he did. And when somebody does that once, we'll see how Durant, whether it's pride or ability or whatever, how he reacts to that, because inevitably that assignment will happen at points. And will Durant use that as motivation, kind of like a lot of the other current Warriors do and the guys they had on the team last year, of, you know, the failures fueling success, future success, is something Draymond's tried to do that, a lot of different guys. And whether that motivates Durant or he goes into some of the same patterns that were frustrating late in that Christmas Day game.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you go back and watch that game, it is a lot of Jefferson just being big enough and relatively quick enough to bother Durant, right? It wasn't like he was doing stuff like Kawhi does where he just engulfs you. He was just there. Like, he did the thing that is just a key to success, which is just be there as much as you can. Even on that last shot, the controversial last play of that game, Jefferson had success in being there by just working and doing the switching. And the Cavs need that, I think, against Durant. I think if there's one little thing of guarding Durant that I think we will see a lot of, Cavs probably have to be daring enough to have LeBron and Durant, but have Jefferson on the floor to switch onto KD. Because I think even if it's LeBron, giving KD just that little bit of room is deadly, and it can end the game. And if you give Kevin Durant a clean look on an end-of-game shot, you're asking to lose, right? Like, you're asking to just give away the game. And at least if Jefferson is there to put an effort in and work and use his body and use his height and use his size, that's about all you can ask of him. And I think that's kind of his role. In the switching, that's all you can ask of him in that situation. Like, the reason Durant even had a slightly contested shot and, of course, led to the trip at the end of that game was because Jefferson just switched and was in the right spot. They need that of him, I think, a whole game to slow Durant as much as you can. And I also just feel like Durant just missed shots he normally makes. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't bet on Durant going 2 of 8 from 3 again, either.
No, he has some nights like that, but usually he's more consistent on that end. Anything else you feel like we need to discuss other than being excited for round two, the last one before the hopeful finals?
Let me ask you about Korver, and it's a pretty simple question. Can he defend Iguodala?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think that's much of a problem. I would worry about them running some action to try to get Korver on someone else, but he can defend Iguodala. He's not that hard to cover at this point in his career.
Cool. And because I think some of the issue with running stuff for Iggy would be too, are you running something just to attack a guy to a fault, right? Like, are you going to run something just to get on Korver?
Yeah, they don't do that. The only guy that they ever do that for is Enes Kanter, because Kerr, relished getting him off the court, especially because Billy Donovan, like, once that he got on his heels with that, he just started taking him out of the game, and they didn't have enough guys to replace it. I mean, it nearly burned them just because that helped fuel going to Ibaka at center. But really, Kerr doesn't do that much, and it's a criticism that I have of him.
That'll be interesting to watch, because you could certainly do that with Korver, and you can do that with Kyrie and a bunch of other guys as well.
You can. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. We'll look forward to the game.
Yeah, thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, man. You have a good one.
Yeah,
good luck with Jared Judy Cabot.
Are you going to put this up Monday, or when do you think you're going to put it up?
I think like Sunday evening. Yeah. Like, I think just get it up like a little bit. Like, I don't usually put anything up on Sunday, but I think I'll probably run it Sunday afternoonish, like later in the day, just because I feel like it'll probably do pretty well even then.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking that just because I want to give it at least a full 24 hours before the game, because the game is a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
So. That's such a weird thing. I understand why they do it, but like, a lot of people don't have it off. So like, it's going to be starting right when work ends here. Might be a late crowd, which could be a factor.
Which, With that, and I find that pretty odd that, like, I was like, oh, 8 o'clock, that's really nice. And I was like, oh, that's 5 o'clock in Oakland. Like, doesn't really make sense.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's like 8:15 after. If they had flipped the games, it would have been fine. You know, like, if they would have done this that way, and so, you know, maybe Warriors fans are coming home, but it's a game that's on TV, that's not a big deal. But it could affect the atmosphere a little bit.
And I don't think it would have mattered if it was on at 10:30. Like, people are going to stay up for this game.
No, it's, you know? It's like, that game. So, we'll see.
Yeah, all right, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thanks again to Chris Manning for taking the time to come on. You can read him at Fear the Sword, and you can also listen to him on Locked on Cavs and follow him on Twitter at CWMWrites. That's CWMWrites. Excited about the game, which is at an earlier 5 p.m. Pacific time. A little bit weird considering it's at Oracle, but makes sense because of the prodigious national TV audience that they are expecting. So excited for the game, even if it is a regular season game between two teams that don't care that much about the regular season because they do seem to care against each other. So excited for it, not putting too much stock into it, but still interesting. Of course, we'll have a podcast afterwards, still working on exactly what form that will take. But the benefit of having a 5 o'clock start is that there's more time to get everything done. So there'll be plenty of material there. Also, of course, for The Athletic and every other thing that I do. So thrilled for the game. Hope you are as well. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com, at Danny LaRue on Twitter, LEROUX. And if you want to support the show, leave a rating, leave a review, and subscribe, download every episode. Those are all the things you can do to help this podcast or any other podcast that you like. Help spread the word in whatever way that you see fit. Thanks so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.